Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Governor John Carney offered his State of the State address at Legislative Hall this week.
At the end of 3 years as your governor, I'm pleased to report that the state of our state is strong and getting stronger.
We'll discuss the priorities Carney laid out for the year and lawmakers' reaction to them with Delaware State News reporter Matt Biddle. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in on the warehouse in Wilmington as the facility for teens on the east side prepares to open. Arts Playlist takes us to the Delaware Contemporary to learn about its new installation, Midnight Mass. And this week's Enlighten Me features transportation plans for the town of Newport. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney delivered his State of the State address Thursday, offering a mix of reflection on his first 3 years in office and priorities for the final year of his first term. Delaware State News reporter Matt Biddle covers state politics and was there for Thursday's speech, and he joined me this week to discuss what Carney said, lawmakers' reaction, and what else to keep an eye on at Legislative Hall. So before we dig into the speech a little bit more deeply, what was your overall feeling about the speech, you know, and what, if anything, it accomplished for the governor?
So I would say it felt a little bit like a campaign speech, which is interesting. And I heard that from a legislator as well. So obviously Carney is up for re-election. He is running. So that's probably deliberate. It was a little more, I would say, looking back than his past State of the States have seemed to be. A little more highlighting, you know, this is where we were and here's how we've progressed. We've done all these great things and such. So you could say it kind of had a feel of a campaign speech. He didn't really lay out a ton of new initiatives. I thought it was a very uncontroversial speech. There were very few things that people could quibble with in there. Guns, notable exception, and, you know, a couple other things people may have some minor issues with, but in general, I thought it was a pretty straightforward, inoffensive speech, a, you know, highlight of his first 3 years.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, he is, I guess, for most intents and purposes, a safe incumbent, but there is that kind of sense sometimes where you do have to kind of remind people, I have done some things. I'm not just running for re-election because I'm here. I'm running because I feel like I've done some things and deserve another 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously he a lot would have to go wrong in the next eight whatever months for him to lose. But, you know, certainly you want to always be proactive and everything. And the state of the state is, I wrote this in my article, it's a really good way to kind of set forth your agenda and your accomplishments to the public. I don't think the governor gets a chance to really speak to the public in quite this way very often.
Good point. Yeah, you mentioned there wasn't very much controversial about this speech, but you did kind of reference one thing, and I do want to get to it, because I think the most controversial part of the speech may have been about the gun bill, something that obviously has been controversial for a while now here in the first state. And my takeaway was, you know, Carney said very little about guns, and maybe what he didn't say may have been as significant as what he did say. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So he mentioned two gun bills. He called for legislators to support these, banning untraceable ghost guns and then banning high-capacity magazines. He did not mention bills that would require a permit to purchase a firearm and bills banning assault weapons. So, you know, that's interesting. You can wonder why he did that. I think that was a very deliberate choice. I'm sure he imagined he thinks that the first two have a much better chance of passing. I mean, I don't know if I'd say he's like giving up on assault weapons and permit to purchase, but I think that's probably a fairly safe assumption. There's just such strong opposition. You know, the Senate Democratic caucus was split over gun bills last year. So, you know, the magazine, that's going to be a tough pull. Ghost guns got out of committee this past week, but it's not coming to the floor immediately. But that'll see some strong opposition.
Yeah, I was going to say, just talking to some legislators myself after the speech, you know, Danny Short, the House Minority Leader, he actually was like, I want to talk more about, you know, a revised death penalty bill that we're going to bring out next week. And even talking to Ernie Lopez, you know, he was for ghost guns. He's I'll support that, but was like, yeah, if there's anybody thinking that there's going to be some kind of deal making over high capacity magazines, like, hey, well, we'll shelve assault weapons if you give us ghost guns and magazines. He shut that down without even any kind of question.
Yeah, I don't think opponents would have to worry about that. I think opponents are in a pretty favorable position in regard to numbers. It's the impetus is really on the supporters of the Bills to sway some people to get the votes. I think if things just proceed as they are, no changes, the magazines does not pass.
Also on the public safety front, a line that kind of quietly stood out to me was when the governor was talking about the group violence intervention initiative that they're doing in Wilmington, its effectiveness. He added a line, kind of small one again, we need a similar approach here in our capital city, speaking of Dover. Mm-hmm. You feel like that's an indication that there may be some more attention being paid by the state government to crime in Dover, particularly as a new police chief mm-hmm. comes in from the outside.
Sure. Yeah, I thought that was definitely interesting. The state has obviously been involved over the past couple of years in really trying to reduce the violence in Wilmington. And I think that they've been, you know, they've seen some success in that. But at the same time, Dover has seen an increase over the past couple of years in shootings and everything. So I would imagine this is probably a hint that they are interested in partnering with the city more. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the new police chief coming in, that would probably make them more willing to work together or whatever. So that is interesting. We'll be neat to see where that goes, but it does seem like they are maybe being a little more proactive in working with the city.
Yeah, it seemed to me, you know, when the new police chief was introduced recently, he did talk a lot about partnering with other mm-hmm. agencies. This isn't a solo act for the city of Dover. And in some ways, I guess I draw some parallels to the city of Wilmington, which, you know, did also bring their police chief Tracy in from the outside, again, trying to maybe bring some fresh ideas, some different ideas. It seems like perhaps the right mix is there mm-hmm. for maybe the state to say, hey, we talked to Wilmington. This is working here. We've talked to some other people. Why don't you try this? And maybe it is the right time for the city of Dover.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe the state can just, you know, bring additional resources that the city doesn't have. And mm-hmm. obviously, you know, a lot of Dover's problems are, you know, they may flow down from Wilmington or whatever, and you sure. know, some of Wilmington's problems then come from Philadelphia or whatever.
Right.
You know, they're not islands unto themselves, so they're all connected, and just working together is really the best way to solve that.
A lot of reason, as you mentioned, that this speech, you know, maybe doesn't make a whole lot of news is because, you know, even of the new initiatives, some of them were kind of rolled out in advance of the speech itself, and we'll start with one of them. That's the one regarding Wilmington schools. You know, $50 million there to renovate a couple school buildings and build actually a new school building as well in the state's largest city. In the past, anytime there's been this kind of let's do something about Wilmington, the first thing you hear, particularly from downstate lawmakers, is, well, wait a second. We've got some issues down here too. What about us? Mm-hmm. Do you sense that we're going to see another round of that as we go forward with this?
Yes, absolutely. I was talking to Danny Shore yesterday, mm-hmm. House Minority Leader, and that's something he brought up. You know, Indian River had two referendums fail last year.
For a third.
Exactly. A couple weeks. So, you know, kind of dire straits there. And that's certainly not the only district. I mean, poverty is pretty big in western Sussex, some parts of western Kent County. So, yeah, there will be a lot of clamoring from lawmakers to, you know, really get some more resources, try to spread that around. And at the same time, there will be people who say, well, Wilmington is Delaware's biggest, most important city, and the needs are the most acute there. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting. I don't know if the governor will end up having to cut a deal and, you know, maybe throw in some additional funding for downstate or something like that. I mean, that'll be decided presumably over the next months by the legislature, but that is something to keep in mind and to watch for.
Yeah, the governor always makes that argument that, you know, for the state to thrive, Wilmington has to thrive. And mm-hmm. and that certainly is an argument. I think even myself talking to Danny Shore, nobody seems to disagree with that. But yeah, as you mentioned, Indian River, a lot of other districts, you know, fighting to get these referendums mm-hmm. passed, and particularly the capital ones that, you know, talking about new buildings. And yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a question where if you're Indian River, you're sitting there saying, like, we've got overcrowding. Mm-hmm. We would love for the state to come in and build a new building for us, and we wouldn't have to ask our taxpayers for any money either. I can see where that may be a tough sell, and as we've seen in the past, mm-hmm. a lot of times these things that they try to do for Wilmington definitely get jammed up because they've got to find something else to do for the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. I think the governor tried to thread that needle a little bit with the opportunity funding.
Sure.
Because that way it's something that can be spread out, mm-hmm. even though some of it's going to be targeted to Wilmington. Mm-hmm. But when you jump into the capital realm, as he's doing this time, it is a different ballgame. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing that maybe the governor could argue is that, well, we are certainly doing plenty for downstate that's not, you know, building a new school. But like he mentioned, they're really focused on high-speed internet in
sure.
Kent and Sussex, which is something that's been a big issue in the rural parts down
Absolutely.
There. You know, much less so in Newcastle. So, you know, something that one part of the state is benefiting, another's not, because the need is only present in one part of the state. So.
Sure. And it is, and the issues are also not always apples to apples. So sure. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Another one that I'm interested in watching play out is the clean water effort by the governor, also rolled out ahead of the state of the state. And we have seen this thing kind of been percolating since the Markell administration. And like a lot of other things, everyone seems to support the concept of cleaning up water and high quality clean water in the state and water infrastructure, but paying for it, like many things, gets torpedoed. Is this proposal likely to be different because it's not asking for new taxes, new fees, new surcharges, whatever you want to call them?
Yes, I think it is, because it does not raise taxes. It would just commit a flat $50 million from excess revenues, basically, that the state has from its various collections. It wouldn't raise any taxes like some of the previous bills would have done. So I think there will be a lot more support for it. There will probably be some people who will be concerned, maybe doing something to create a bureaucracy, or, they may have concerns about they'll want to see details, where exactly will the money be going and such. But I think in general, this is much more likely to pass than the prior water bills. Pete Schwarzkopf was raving about this water bill, how much it's needed.
Yeah. And I think, I guess the question I could see some who have been supporting this for some time asking is, does this make clean water like farmland preservation, open space preservation, where there's a line in it every year and it fluctuates depending on how the budget looks? And if you feel like clean water is really important, isn't that in need of a more sustained, continued revenue source rather than, well, we've got some extra revenues this year? My guess is, and maybe you tell me what you think, at this point, people who want clean water, something done, they'll take the half loaf over no loaf.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say that I think that, while there are people who are just happy to have this, there are some who would say that more is needed. We can't just do this one amount. The original bill said that $500 million was needed over the next five years. This is obviously just a fraction of that, and it may be a start, but some lawmakers would say that, we really should be committing to this, and if that means, raising taxes a little bit, we should do that. But don't expect that to happen this year. No tax raises on that.
Anything else stand out proposal-wise from the governor's speech for you?
He mentioned the providing free tuition to UD, DSU, and Deltec for students who age out of foster care, which I thought was interesting. I don't know how big that population is or anything. I can't imagine it'll be a tremendous fiscal impact.
Right.
But it's something that, as Pete Schwarzkopf said, basically, these kids are just kind of, in a lot of cases, they feel forgotten, ignored. This is a way to really give them a brighter future, really help them out. And so he's really optimistic about the impact it can have. And I would imagine it sails through the General Assembly pretty easily.
Yeah, we've seen some other efforts in recent years trying to work on this issue of those kids who are aging out, and where do they go and what they do. And it seems like every once in a while it becomes an issue that gets a lot of attention and then it kind of fades. So yeah, I think the speaker was kind of making that point, like, hey, we need to kind of keep at this, and we'll see if that goes through quickly as you think. Mm-hmm. Anything else maybe notable by its absence from the state of the state? We talked a little bit about guns, but maybe beyond that.
He really stayed away from controversial stuff. I mean, I think anyone who's expecting to hear about something like, marijuana was,
Right.
that wasn't going to happen. I don't know. There's not a lot that stood out in terms of what was missing, I guess. Nothing that comes to mind, I don't think. We'll obviously get more details on the spending proposals and such with his budget release on Thursday. The state of the state is kind of a precursor to that in a lot of ways. So that'll fill in some of the details.
And I was going to say, is there anything else to look for in the budget that maybe, it's just more of a budgetary type of issue that people will probably want to keep an eye on when that's released, as opposed to what you might not hear in the state of the state?
Yeah, so the budget will have, his capital budget proposal will have $50 million for clean water, $50 million for Wilmington schools. And he mentioned yesterday there's another $50 million in capital improvements he wants to do without specifying what that is. So that'll be interesting to see what exactly he's planning. It could be, making further investments in upgrading state buildings. I don't know, just doing more with roads or something like that.
Would that be where the money for the new family courts would reside?
That could very well be it, yes. I'm not quite sure exactly where that stands, but that could easily be it.
I just think that they had mentioned that, and that was something I know a couple of legislators were really happy to hear about after the state of the state.
Yeah, that's been long overdue in the eyes of a lot of people.
First 2 weeks in the books at Lake Hall now. Anything significant in those first 2 weeks from the legislator side of things?
Let's see. So ghost guns got out of committee Wednesday. That was, you know, controversial hearing, as all gun control bills are for the most part. It's been fairly straightforward. This is the second leg of a session, so things just pick up where they left off. So the second leg is always much busier when you get started. There was the Kent County lodging tax, which would have directed the proceeds to the DE turf. That was controversial. The Senate passed a bill in the first week back that would undo that. That's in the House now, and that's expected to pass probably next week pretty easily. And then, you know, they've got other things pending, certainly. The House still has to vote on ghost guns. They may do that next week. I think they'll probably wait until they come back in March after the break, though. So we'll see. But it's been a good first 2 weeks, but nothing, like, crazy yet.
And it is an election year, so the amount of crazy you'll see may be limited in that regard. Mm. One thing we did want to finish on, because it was something that the governor talked about in his speech, was he wants to plant 1 million trees in Delaware over 10 years. So I'll ask you the classic question. If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? Or maybe in this case, you know, what tree would you want to plant?
Ooh, I think I'd say I'll be a redwood, I guess. They're tall. They live a long time. Seems like a good choice. A lot of things.
I'll just go with the easy answer. The state tree is the American holly. So I'm just gonna roll with the American holly.
I didn't even know that was it. So I learned something new.
We try to learn something. Matt Biddle for the Delaware State News. We appreciate you coming in. We look forward to having you in on a regular basis to chat about what's going on over at Leg Hall.
Thank you.
Thanks to Matt Biddle of the Delaware State News for joining us on The Green this week. You can find Matt's reporting on the General Assembly and state politics at DelawareStateNews.net. And The Green continues in a moment with an update on The Warehouse as it gets set to open and serve Wilmington teens on the city's east side and beyond. That's next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The first piece of the expansive Reach Riverside Community Revitalization Project is nearly set to open its doors on Wilmington's east side. The warehouse, built as community space for teens by teens, could be ready as soon as next month, with the final touches being placed on the former Prestige Academy Charter School as we speak. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been following the warehouse's development since fall 2018, and he updates what the facility and its programming will look like in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to discuss what he found. Let's start by reminding people what the warehouse is. What is the concept of the warehouse?
Okay. Well, you know, the idea here is to have a safe and supervised place for teens to go after school and in the evening hours. Now, that's a really big need in Wilmington's Riverside community, which is an area that's known for its low-income demographic and a very high, relatively high crime rate. It's also fair to say that this is a need that exists throughout the city of Wilmington. The warehouse will be, however, more than just a place for kids to hang out. I mean, thanks to a growing network of partnering organizations, the warehouse will give teens a place to get their homework help, to learn how to cook, to watch movies, to explore their interests in things like dance, art, physical fitness. They'll also be able to get tips on writing resumes, how to find a job, and very importantly, how to stay healthy.
As you kind of read that laundry list, it kind of strikes me that what will actually be available at the warehouse has grown significantly since the project was first pitched. How much has it grown, and what services and programs will it now provide when it opens?
Well, the warehouse started as a project of the Kingswood Community Center about 4 years ago, shortly after Logan Herring became executive director there. It has now become part of this much larger Reach Riverside initiative, which is a program designed to revitalize the entire Riverside community in Northeast Wilmington. Now, at the start, Logan Herring was trying to develop a program that would rely on a handful of organizations, four or five or so, that would give teens in the neighborhood something to do after school. Then he started talking up the idea and pitching it to businesses, to foundations, to other nonprofits, and all of a sudden it just experienced a viral kind of growth. Foundations got interested, and then the nonprofits, other community centers, state agencies, even businesses. And now the warehouse has the potential to be an operation that actually does serve teens from the entire city of Wilmington. They've now got, and catch this, 136 groups that are pledging to offer some form of programming and support services at the site. Some of them are going to have office space at the warehouse. Others will be scheduling activities there on a regular basis. And for others, it'll be occasional involvement. But what's most important about all this, and what's most interesting, is that the teenagers themselves have been involved in planning for the last year and a half, and they're going to be involved in planning new programs as things move forward. The motto at the warehouse is for teens by teens, and thus far it seems to be working.
We'll get to that a little bit more in a moment, but first, with any project of this scale, funding is a big question. But it seems, as the project kind of went viral, as you said, it kind of got a boost economically as well. It's in pretty good shape in that regard. At this juncture, does it have what it needs not only to get off the ground, but to be sustainable?
Most definitely does. You're talking about $8 million that they needed for the to get started. They raised the $8 million, and they reached their goal thanks in part to $1 million grant from Christiana Care, six-figure contributions from the Longwood Foundation and other major businesses. The building itself had been the site of this former Prestige Academy Charter School. When Prestige Academy shut down because of declining enrollments, Capital One Bank was left holding the mortgage. Capital One couldn't find a buyer, and so they donated the site as well. So, taking all of this together, they've got $8 million to get started. They needed an operating budget of $1 million to $1.3 million for the first year. They've already covered that, and they're starting to raise money for 2021. Now, moving forward, the operating money is going to come from a variety of sources. You know, the groups that use the space are going to be paying rent. Some of the programs that will be offered here are going to qualify for state or federal grants, things like the Department of Education's opportunity grants that Governor Carney set up a couple of years ago, things like that. Foundations and businesses will chip in too. I mean, and at the start, this foundation support is going to be crucial, but the managers expect to reduce their reliance on this philanthropy to somewhere in the neighborhood of 15% of their budget in a couple of years once they get themselves firmly established.
Let's get back to this for teens by teens concept that you mentioned. To date, it seems like this project has kind of kept the promise of for teens by teens. How has it done that thus far? And how have the youth that it will serve been part of kind of actually just getting this whole concept rolling?
Well, the for teens by teens piece got started in the summer of 2018. That was, at that time, the warehouse latched on to some teenagers who had participated in the Dual School, which is a project-based learning program that we've talked about on this program a couple of times before. And they hired the teenagers who had been involved with Dual School and got them to start researching what the warehouse really ought to look like. The kids went out into the community. They met with other teenagers. They created some pilot programs. They tested them out on younger students who were in the schools at the community education building. And then after they had an idea of what they wanted, they started meeting, the teens themselves, with government leaders, with legislators, with the heads of foundations, even had a meeting with Governor Carney to try to explain why this project was so important to them. Now, I talked to a number of these teenagers this week, and they told me that they felt like they had built this place. Some of them are referring to it already as their second home. And now, and if these kids keep their word, the warehouse is going to be more than just a place for kids to drop in. They're going to have some ownership. It's going to be a place that they care about and that they truly make their own.
With that in mind, what are the goals for how the warehouse will serve these teens? How many does it plan to serve? How does it plan to make the facility available, not just on the east side, but as you mentioned, kind of beyond?
Well, you know, Patrick Ryan, the programming director, says the goal is to serve 250 students in the first year. And you know, they're really not sure how many are going to show up when they open the doors. One of the teenagers there said, well, you know, we could have way too many, or it might only be a handful that show up those first couple of days. But you know, so while it's a little unclear what they're going to get and how that's going to work out, I can easily see 250 kids making use of this facility on a regular basis. Now, even so, they do have some logistical issues. The warehouse is a half a mile walk from Howard High School, which is the closest high school. It's a mile from Freire Charter School, which is the next closest. And the other high schools are really farther away. Now, they do have plans in the works to partner with the Wilmington Department of Parks and Recreation to run a shuttle bus loop that would link to community centers and other parts of the city over in the West End, down in Southbridge, and so on, other places where teens tend to go after school. So there would be that shuttle bus loop. They're going to start piloting that at some point in March. The other thing that's really interesting, and you know, certainly we'll find out more about it as this evolves, is that the University of Delaware is working on this vehicle-to-grid technology with electric buses, and they're hoping to partner with the university as that project moves along and use these electric buses as the shuttle system. And with this vehicle-to-grid technology, I don't know a whole lot about it, but the idea here is that the buses themselves generate surplus electricity, which could then get plugged back into the grid and perhaps help power the warehouse in another way.
As your story notes, this is really the first piece of the Reach Riverside Community Revitalization Project. Tell us a little bit about where things stand with other parts of that project. What's next with the Reach Riverside project?
Okay. Well, you know, Reach Riverside is a big deal. It's the revitalization of a corner of Wilmington that has long been neglected. You know, and the biggest and the most visible piece of the project is going to be the demolition of nearly 300 housing units, most of them row homes that are owned by the Wilmington Housing Authority, and replacing them with 400 or so housing units, which would mostly be owner-occupied. Some of them sold actually at market rate and others at subsidized prices that are dependent upon the buyer's income. The idea here is that some of the new homes are going to be built, and once this first group is built, then they'll tear down a portion of the old Riverside housing projects, build some more, tear some down, and so on. So this is going to take a number of years. Anyhow, the first phase is expected to start in May, when construction of 74 homes, most of them are going to be 2 and 3 bedroom units, would begin. Now, I don't know anything about the pricing, any details on the pricing or this construction timeline yet, but you know, from what I've observed with other projects, I would estimate that the first homes are going to be ready for occupancy spring or summer of next year if all goes well. Now, housing is certainly the biggest part of this revitalization with Reach Riverside, but some other components include building a new Kingswood Community Center, possibly expanding the Eastside Charter School to include high school grades, and developing programs that would make a dent in the unemployment and healthcare deficiencies in the area. You know, at times like this, I really wish that I had a time machine. I'd be able to look like 15 years in the future. We talked a couple of months ago about major redevelopment in Claymont, and we know that there are plans for a port project at the site of that former DuPont Edgemoor plant. And now we've got Reach Riverside. It's going to take a while, but this entire area along the Delaware River, from downtown Wilmington all the way up to north to the state line, is going to start taking about a very different look. And right now, we can just only imagine how it's going to turn out.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. His piece on the warehouse, set to start serving Wilmington teens in just over a month, is at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues with Arts Playlists and more on the latest work to be featured at the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington. Stay with us for that next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thank you. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Contemporary is opening a new lobby installation called Midnight Mass from Philadelphia native Amy Potsick. Midnight Mass uses over 250 feet of silk in panels suspended on wires created specifically for the Delaware Contemporary's atrium with photographs taken by Potsick printed on them. In this week's arts playlist, the Delaware Contemporary's Gretchen Hupfel Curator of Contemporary Art, Catherine Page, joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss the installation.
Midnight Mass, what's it all about? Give us all the background.
Midnight Mass, well, it's going in the lobby of the Delaware Contemporary, and we're very excited because it launches 2020, which is a centennial year that we are celebrating the whole year as the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And so we're featuring a lot of female artists. And for the lobby, our idea is to establish, well, that wow factor. And so Amy Potsick's installation, it will feature her work with over 250 linear feet of silk. And what she does is she takes these photographs and then prints them on silk. And so it's this monumental, site-specific installation that involves these panels that are suspended on wires in the high part of the atrium, what we call in the architectural museum world, the plenum. And these semi-translucent silk pieces have imagery of silhouetted tree branches. And so you have the dark tree set against the midnight blue of the sky. And so what you will see is this weaving and dancing throughout the space in this sweeping, graceful, and abstract imagery. And so by grafting the panels in this space and extending them from the entrance toward the clear story windows, her work really will enhance the museum's architecture. But it also intends to affirm how art is related to human experience as viewers gaze at this sense of being in this forest canopy.
Catherine, I assume, I'm going out on a limb here, I assume that, I hope my limb doesn't come crashing down. I'm assuming that silk printing has been around for quite some time. Correct me if I'm wrong. How long has Amy Potsick been doing this?
Oh, wow. That's a very good question. I know that this kind of series she has been doing for the last 5 years, because she was in an exhibition years ago and had done this similar kind of process. But beyond that, I don't know how long she's been doing this particular series, but I know at least for the past 5 years. They're so beautiful because of the effect of the draping of the silk. And, you know, the nature of silk in itself is it is so conducive to this willowy drapery effect.
It sounds beautiful just the way you describe it. We're talking to Catherine Page. She is the Gretchen Hupfel Curator of Contemporary Art at the Delaware Contemporary about a new lobby installation for 2020. It's called Midnight Mass. Are lobby installations different than gallery installations, Catherine?
They are, and the reason why is it's site-specific. So you have to understand the space, the dimensions, you have to understand the lighting, you have to understand the HVAC system. And so there are a lot of considerations when working with a site-specific place. As opposed to the gallery, it's generally on the walls. Sometimes we hang things from the ceiling, but it's not as big a consideration as when you're talking about a lobby. So many other factors have to weigh in.
Gotcha. Amy Potsick's work has been exhibited locally, nationally, and even internationally. Give us some more of her background.
She is an artist who received her MFA in photography from the prestigious San Francisco Art Institute. She also has a BA in photojournalism and English literature from Indiana University, where she graduated with distinguished honors and was a member of the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. So you can imagine, when I wrote the press release, I was really worried how she would respond to it. She also has held faculty appointments at the University of California, Berkeley, Olone College, and San Francisco Art Institute. So she has a quite an impressive bio.
I'm fascinated by this exhibit. We're talking to Catherine Page about a new lobby installation for the new year, 2020. It's called Midnight Mass by Amy Potsick. It goes on display January 24th. It'll stay on display through April 25th of 2020. An opening reception for this installation on Friday, February 7th. Talk about that.
That will be open on Friday the 7th, as you said, from 5 to 9 p.m. during our art loop. And so we're looking forward to that.
Take us on a walk through your eyes for this lobby installation. Make us imagine what we're going to see when we walk in.
Okay. So when you walk in, you need to think about, like, what must it have been like? So to whet your imagination, like in medieval basilicas that were designed to confer this cosmological concept of the Dome of Heaven, what she is going to be doing is you'll see this festooning of her silk in this perspective that conjures up these grand processions during what the Christian tradition of celebration of Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve. And so the sheer immediacy of the work, we hope, evokes this sense of triumph and joy. And with this vast array, or this illusion of this Dome of Heaven, it serves as a metaphor for celestial realms with this dramatic sweeping arms that symbolize this welcoming gesture for the viewers. And that's what we want, right? We want people to feel welcome. And the other thing that I find so fascinating about her work is, as an observer of the natural world, her compositions of this undulating elliptical arches, they rest within this hemispherical stage, like this pointing to a global call for action. So her work, while it is breathtakingly beautiful and also very enchanting, it underscores the urgency on climate change and the need for environmental protections. So she creates both this visceral and cerebral connection to trees and the natural world. So her silk, it also holds a double entendre. It offers a metaphorical protective covering, while also drawing attention in the viewer's purview to universal deforestation and the loss of the Earth's essential protective layer.
Thanks to the Delaware Contemporaries, Gretchen Hupfel, Curator of Contemporary Art, Catherine Page, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Midnight Mass is open now and runs through April 25th. And The Green concludes next with Enlightened Me and a look at transportation plans for the town of Newport. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The town of Newport and regional planners are taking a look at transportation in the town, following up on a study that recommended a train station be built there. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with a planner at the Wilmington Area Planning Council about the new study, which seeks public input for the first time Monday.
So what is WMAPCO looking at with the Newport Transportation Study? Okay. This is a follow-up to a study that was completed back in 2012. At that study, we were looking at the potential to reopen a train station in Newport. Newport had train service back before Amtrak took over, I think. Anyway, back to the 80s. There was an old station building that burnt down also somewhere in the 80s. And so the idea of opening a SEPTA station with access to SEPTA service was something that the town's been interested in probably 10 years or more. And so this study is sort of a follow-up to the first study, which showed that it was feasible. We did ridership information. We did sort of a concept design for the station, figured out where parking could go. And what we hope to do now is, now that some time has passed and the town of Newport is sort of moving forward with trying to be more walkable, bikeable, this is more of a full transportation study. Like, what do they have? What do they need? What do the sidewalks look like? What do the crosswalks look like? There's a project underway to attach along the waterfront, along the river, to the Jack Markell Trail. And so then it's, you know, not just looking at that. In fact, that would be a separately funded study that's underway now. So we just want to make sure that we touch all of those bases. There is a logistics center that's to be opening up at the former GM plant up off of Boxwood Road. How is that going to impact the town? So that's included in our study area. And really the goal is to make it more walkable and bikeable in town, to make sure that traffic that'd be coming in to have regional, you know, people park and ride at the train station, what that impact might be on traffic in the area, what truck traffic might look like in the area, and really then how do pedestrians get around? How does the town stay more walkable? There's a proposal for 400,000 square feet of development right in the center of town. How can that all be worked into one thing? So it's not as simple as just one train station or something else, but how do people then move around, and how can Newport sort of advance itself as a walkable, bikeable town?
So where in the transportation study is WillMapCo right now?
So far, we have hired a consultant team, and we had an advisory committee meeting. We invited stakeholders. This was back in, it's been a while now, I'm guessing November, really just to start getting a feel for what the issues are with the town. So we've had town officials sit down with us. The idea was just to get as many of the local business owners involved. It is hard. There's not a town civic group or a neighborhood group. So we'll really work through the town for residential involvement. And that really starts Monday night, where we will sit down with folks at a visioning session. We'll explain what it is we're here to do. And then we will break them into smaller groups. We'll try to get down to groups of 6 to 8 people, so they can just have a conversation about the things they like about Newport, the things they don't like, the things they want to see grow. And really, we call it a visioning session. It really gives us a lot more insight into what residents think.
Can you contextualize transportation in Newport within the region? You know, you guys are regional planners. Like, how does making sure that transportation is good in Newport impact connectivity in the whole region?
Well, actually, that goes back towards the study that we're doing. So if you're going to add a new bike trail that's going to be part of the Newcastle County bike trail system, you want it to have good connectivity at every end. Connecting that bike trail to the Hall Trail is a great thing because it'll bring a lot of people to the Hall Trail, which is already established and can get you to Newcastle or to Wilmington. So for bike riders, you need to have good connections so you can get to that trail. As I said, there's nothing more annoying than loading your bikes up onto a bike rack on your car and then going to a trailhead to start your day. If you could just connect everything, people will ride from their neighborhoods, and it makes it more simple. There's already a very strong highway network through here. In fact, that's one of the benefits of reusing the GM plant as a logistics center. And so we feel very strongly that truck traffic could stay off of surface streets because State Route 141 is a highway. You know, it's directly linked to I-95. So in that context, you know, that's good for us that truck traffic can stay off of the surface streets. But there's a lot of traffic that does flow through Newport on State Route 4. It sort of hits a wall at times within Newport. And I guess we wouldn't necessarily want to see traffic flow through there faster, but we'd want it to move a little more freely. And so the idea being that you look at all the signals in that area and you set them up so that vehicles can move at a fairly consistent speed. I mean, with pedestrians, you'd want that speed to be about 25 miles an hour, but you don't want it to be. They come flying down the hill into, you know, from the east at 50, and then stop and sit at a couple of signals for three or four cycles of the signal. So if we create a way to monitor or meter traffic, it'll take the same amount of time to get through town, but you'll be going 25 miles an hour all the way through, which will be much better for the pedestrians and the people who are in the town who want to be able to walk around. So regionally, this becomes a very important hub. Connecting the station to a trail is always good because folks will ride. Folks who use trains generally are either going to walk or ride more, ride their bikes more than folks who don't ride transit. They tend to stay in cars. It would be much better, as I said, for a station that could serve a public that is in a growing town, because then you get potentially more train riders. We could be attracting folks who live in Philadelphia now who don't want to live in Philadelphia because it's so expensive. And if we see new housing go up in Newport, then they could still use that train to get back and forth to work. That takes cars off the highways. That helps us and helps Newport to grow. I mean, they see that's where their economic growth could be from. Wilmington, you know, that's an established station. Plenty of people know how to use that. Newark, we're improving that station, and that is very walkable. It's adjacent to some other areas. So this is another step for the state of Delaware to try to encourage transit use, encourage the use of the train service, which we pay for. We pay SEPTA to come down here, and so the more people we have ride it, the better bang we get for our buck.
So what's the timeline and the next steps in this plan?
For us, it's a one-year study. Again, since we started in November, we would like to be wrapping up this time next year, just be complete. The goal is to have it more seamless, that this study has results on what the station should look like, where parking can be made, any little changes we need to make towards the original concept that was done for the station, and hand it over to DelDOT and DTC so they can immediately take the money they've set aside and start moving forward. Having done this study in a community type of environment, if we go looking for a federal funding for the station, having a community study behind us helps, because we're already showing the federal government that we're working with the community to try to do this. It's not just somebody's one person's idea, or it's the state's idea. This is a community resource that we're developing, and a community transportation study shows that there's a lot of buy-in that helps you when you go looking for very competitive funds at the federal level.
Thanks to Will Mapco planner Dave Gula and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out the Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware State News reporter Matt Biddle, contributor Larry Nangest, and Delaware Public Media Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.